talking during my show.
Blog Talk Radio.
Someone cares. Like, thousands of listeners care about your girlfriend's family and where she lives and what she does.
He was just talking, and then we started the show. I don't think he really...
He didn't know, but I said 20 seconds.
Yeah.
And in Louisiana land, I guess it's 20 minutes.
I was talking to Kyan.
You're not...
Oh, well, that's nice. Someone's got to. Kyan seriously sits in my... Well, he doesn't work. First of all, he comes to town, and he gets, like, all these jobs. I'm talking about you.
I think you locked him in the basement. This is like a kidnapping.
So he gets all these jobs when he comes here.
He gets let out a few hours a day.
Yeah. I've lived here 30 years and never had a job. He has like two in like 2 weeks.
The poor guy's on lockdown.
Then, when he doesn't work, he's just sitting in my basement. I'm like, do you want to leave? Do you want to like go upstairs and eat? I don't think you want to see my mom.
But you're anemic to real
work. You don't want to see my mom. That's what it is.
Okay.
They get along, though.
I don't think you're feeding him.
I asked him, I go, you want to eat? He goes, no, I'm not hungry.
I'm he's trying to keep his weight.
I cook steak.
He looks
fabulous.
I cook
eggs.
Yes,
he does. Well, that's why.
Is there something in the contract?
You
got to cut weight for the movie, or what are you doing? Today?
Oh, maybe that's what it is.
See,
maybe
on the Matthew Aaron diet plan, rocking some turkey chili.
This is wrong. We're talking about when he's not even, he doesn't even have a microphone to defend himself.
Yeah, I know.
That's okay.
That's how we like to do our hit and runs.
I never have a microphone. You guys are always
Could we have opened the show?
I've said way worse.
Could we have opened the show with a Beatles song, or would we have gotten sued by Michael Jackson's estate?
Yeah, right. Didn't he lose all the Beatles songs?
Oh, did he?
They sold them.
No.
Yeah, his family sold them because they're
they needed
really
money.
Good people.
Yeah, they needed
a lot of money.
They needed money for attorneys.
Welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show, www.thematthewaaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. You get into the Matthew Aaron Show on Facebook. You go to the search bar. You type in the Matthew Aaron Show. You click search or whatever, and then click like. We're on Stitcher. We're on, what else are we on?
Twitter.
We're on other shit, aren't we?
Yeah.
Twitter.
At Matt Aaron Show.
Twitter.
You said,
iTunes. And what's the Lee Capreas handle?
Lee Capreas at El Capreas on Twitter.
Okay. What else are we on? iTunes. Yeah. Where you can subscribe.
Hey.
And we're here at 603 North Hollywood Way.
Lee Capreas, hello.
Alex Luisi. That's two eyes.
With two Z's.
Do you kind of wish you were at 603 North Hollywood Way right now?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
So do I.
Eating my pre-nap Joe Mantegna pizza.
I can't talk too much about this, but there's something going on that would bring me back to L.A. for a while. And it was one of those situations where, like, you're doing, like, all this negotiating and all this, like, you know, you're working out deals and stuff. And you're kind of like, maybe I will come back for free if you just bring me now. Because the weather here blows.
Oh, yeah.
Like, right now... They could probably get me with coupons.
Yeah. Jamba Juice coupons.
It has snowed 58 inches in Chicago since I've been home.
I liked how your mom took a picture of you shoveling this morning and put it on Facebook.
She has no life.
She has no life. First of all, the driveway looks great.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
The walkway?
Did you enjoy my...
You stopped at the walkway.
Yeah, I'm not doing the walkway.
I know you don't use your front entrance like most Americans, but...
I don't want people to use my walkway. That's my way of saying...
Go to the garage.
Please go home.
I'll do it.
Did you see my motion, though, in the picture? I have good shovel motion.
Little wristy.
No. No.
Yeah.
Have you been shoveling at all?
I don't shovel.
To operate a shovel is to understand its zen. You push with one hand, turn with the other.
You think I get
Yeah, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really do the turn, though. I do a lift.
Do a lift?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Only because I feel like with the turn, it gets all over the place if you don't do it
well. The lift, think about
and
it.
If
from
it's
a,
not good packing stuff.
From an exercise standpoint, the lift is very good for your solar plexus.
You got to bend the
Oh,
knees.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're doing it right.
Oh, Kyan's going to say hi. Say hi, Kyan.
Featuring Kyan Laredo.
Oh, wow. Wow. You see what you get for that? For
and
being nice?
If you're listening...
He gives himself a title and everything.
If you're listening,
it
he
just
looks
it just,
like that, what he just
it,
said.
Yeah, he does.
He
does.
It just
yeah,
moved.
Does.
It just moved.
Oh, my God. What's wrong with you? What do you mean it just moved?
I'm kidding.
You're so gay.
Yeah.
And coming from me.
Yeah, Luisi.
Let me tell you something. Vivek Tiwari... is going to call in. Well, I record an interview with him.
Oh.
So I don't want to lie to our people and say he's going to call in because that could be a whole Oh, man, I didn't edit the beginning of it or the end of it. People are going to hear this, like, whole weird conversation now that I think about it.
What were you talking about?
Oh, Jesus. I have no idea. This is terrible. This is, like, the worst thing that ever happened.
This just even went up in interest for me, and I was already excited.
I don't know, but I think there's this whole, like, three-minute bullshit session going on beforehand.
What were you talking about, baseball?
Oh, fuck. Well, I apologize ahead of time to Vivek, because he's you know, you record these things, and you say, hey, how you doing?
What
and
did you
do
say
this
to
whole,
the guest,
like, song and dance, and then you go, all right, I'm recording now, or whatever. Well, the whole part before that's going to play, and then you're going to hear me say I'm recording now. Ignore that part, because obviously the whole thing played anyways. Oh, I've been very
busy. Wait, are you like...
And we don't have an intern here to edit my interviews at the moment.
Were you just like, oh, I got to do this bullshit interview. I hate this shit. All right, now we're on. So, I'm here with... Is it like that?
Well, we're going to find out, aren't
oh,
we?
Oh, boy.
We're
you don't even remember
out.
It.
I can tell you this. It's an aces interview. It's great.
I'm sure.
It's a really good interview, really informative, but in an entertaining way. And also, the guy's great. Vivek's great.
Cool.
Like, he's outstanding. You're going to love listening to him.
This is a pretty big guest.
I'll tell you, I was prepared to be like, I was prepared for him to be like the musical version of Harvey Weinstein and kind of bore the piss out of me. He was great. He's really great.
I doubt
Harvey Weinstein
would be boring.
It's fine. Not that Harvey's boring. It's just
no.
that.
Anything but.
Yeah, you just get yelled at a lot.
Yeah.
I'd love to interview Harvey still.
I would, too.
That's like my
dream still would interview. I'm terrified of him. I still would do it.
I want to talk about Mimic for like an hour.
Mimic?
Just to annoy the shit out of him. Oh, he's a terror. In a good way.
We're recording.
No, we're live now.
That was good. That was appropriate for that interview.
Sorry about that. All right.
Everyone thinks Luisi plays a dumb character on our show.
First of all,
that he plays one.
First of all, that was like the first funny thing that Luisi ever said on the show, so I think we got to give him credit for that.
No, he's had his Beavis and Butthead moments.
Okay.
He's had a few. Remember when Luisi used to bring his ex-girlfriend to the show and I used to rip on her, like, right to her face? That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that was terrible.
That was pretty amazing. Oh, and now he's pregnant with new girlfriend.
Yes.
Or new lady friend.
We're doing June. And
speaking to the microphone, what are you doing?
We're doing June, and I'm having a baby boy.
Oh, it's a boy?
Oh, you know the gender.
Yay! Are you going to name it Vito? Don't do it.
He would be.
Your dad doesn't even like you that much to begin with. What are you doing?
They showed us the
dad?
Cannoli on the ultrasound.
You know you're like the third favorite. And you may be the fourth favorite in Vito's line of thinking.
Yeah.
He may be like Danny, Rick... Fill in the blank, Alex.
Yeah, there's a brother that I don't know.
Player to be named later,
yeah.
Alex.
Yeah, exactly.
You are below the player to be named later. So we know Vito's out. You're not naming him Vito. Unless you need money from Vito, then maybe you want to name him Vito. That's a, it could go either way when you think about it.
But seriously, congratulations on the little one.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
No, that's true. That's true. So I can't put you on the spot about a marriage? No. Just a bastard child?
We're talking about it and taking it slow. And
bastard children happen all the time, though. Don't worry about it. It's not even like a thing anymore. Remember Bastard at Carolina? They don't even make that movie anymore. They're not all bad people anymore.
There are no more bastards. It's not like a socially unacceptable thing to have a baby out of wedlock.
You know what I forgot, too? That movie's pretty great.
Yeah, it's not
It's
bad.
Angelica Houston.
Yeah.
She's great.
That's right.
She's amazing.
I love her.
How is she not... How's she not doing more stuff?
I think
she's popular. Everyone knows who she is.
I think she scares the shit out of people.
She's so great.
I know. She's really talented and confident and smart, and she picks great projects.
I'm
but
madly
it's
in
because
love with
she's
her.
Actually starting to look like the rat in The Witches.
So what? That's great. Okay. Why was Angelica Houston on that witch show, that American Horror Story? She probably turned it down. She's probably smart.
That's a great show, by the way.
Oh, come on.
Megan watches it, and I love it.
Of course.
Sorry.
I will never, ever, ever watch that
show. I'll watch it. I'll give it a chance.
You should.
We did talk about this.
It's too many costumes. It looks real fucking campy.
What's the girl's name? Precious? Who's the big one?
Gabby Sidibe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's good.
I don't think it's Sidibe. I don't think that's right.
I think it's the bidet.
No, it's to the bay or something.
It's French.
Oh. To the bay.
Well,
she looks very. She looks how it sounds, French. Okay, it's French.
Well,
she's really good in it.
I've made an attempt on.
Is
the name,
she good in it?
All right.
Yeah. I love how he's like the American Horror Story guru.
I know.
Here. Oh yeah, Gabourey. She's fantastic.
I attempted the name,
program.
Which is a step up from the big one from Precious.
Which one?
Everyone
in Precious is big, buddy.
Well, yeah.
Monique?
No.
Why isn't Monique doing anything? You win
she's
an Oscar,
so good.
And then you're like, you know, that's really great, but we only have one fat black woman in a movie every 10 years. That's really what
that
it is.
That was quite
right?
a year for her. She did press.
On BET. At least Queen Latifah's getting Fox.
Well, and not to forget her other major role, Beerfest.
Yeah, like, what the fuck? Why isn't she in more shit?
Yeah,
I don't know. She was good. She's a really great actress. Yeah.
She's great.
She is.
I think I'm going to get into acting.
I think that acting is something you could do because we know some Hollywood actors, and they are kind of like Luisi.
Painful.
Are they not?
Yeah, something like that. They are like Luisi, yeah.
That was
the
best.
Yeah.
That was so bad.
So the second movie I do, you're going to be in. Here's the thing. I could kind of tell since like Lenny and Chuck are in the movie and they're producing too, that I could kind of tell Giuliano and Luisi were like, I didn't get offered a role and I'm producing.
I really don't care.
You kind of do.
I don't.
We'll put you in one of the homo. We'll put you in one of the homo clubs.
I feel like once
you kind of got that look going. I got to tell you.
Thanks.
I think a lot of my gay friends saw that picture of us on Facebook.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce, by the way.
You made some guys kind of
like,
jealous.
I'm the poster boy in Boys Town now.
Well, you're more svelte and better dressed than we are.
What the hell is svelte?
Means you're cool.
Did you comment? On what?
On the picture of you and Alex.
No, it's sexy, though.
Yeah,
It looks like I'm kissing him.
Yeah, it looks, he's looking into my
Bruce
eyes.
Took it at a very inopportune moment.
And I've got the fruitiest drink in front
right,
of me.
Right,
so
I can't believe you missed hanging out with Bruce.
I had to be up at
5:30.
About you. Oh, I had to be up, dude.
He didn't ask about him.
Yeah, he did.
No, he didn't. I'm just kidding.
He even asked about Caesar.
You mean
okay?
the night of the show?
He even asked about Caesar. He's
the night of the show or another night? Wednesday?
Both nights.
Both nights, so you went out again after Wednesday?
Before Wednesday.
Okay, you didn't call me up?
It was a last second thing. That one was.
Okay.
That one was because that's when you and I drove down because your battery died. You get a new battery yet?
Yeah. Yeah.
How'd that happen? Did you just call AAA?
No, I changed it out myself. I'm hands-on.
Oh, you went to NTB and bought a battery and came home and put it in?
Yeah.
They didn't call me, Bruce.
We did on Wednesday. You were here. You saw him.
Yeah, on
you
Wednesday.
You sit next to him. Talk about how much you two love Man of Steel.
That was okay. The other way around.
Chuck's such a loser.
I know.
Chuck is such a loser. Since he's not here, can I say
he really,
what a fucking loser he is that he loves that fucking movie
all
so
of the schmaltz of Superman, he loves it. He
Why is he
it.
Such a dork? He's the grumpiest asshole next to me on the planet. Yet his favorite movies are like Rocky and Superman, the schmaltziest American
Karate Kid
ever. Yeah, he loves
anything
that shit.
John D. Avildsen.
I don't get it.
Yeah,
I don't get it because you're like the most negative prick otherwise. And he has a girlfriend now too,
what?
Which I'm trying to talk about.
Maybe the uplifting underdog stories of those movies are kind of an insight into his failed idealism.
Maybe he's waiting for that movie about the guy that works at the Secretary of the State's office.
Was he dating a blind deaf mute or something? Or?
No, she's hot.
Is she?
Yeah.
Oh, there was a picture she showed us.
Yes, they're going out now.
Wow.
They're officially, they had the talk, last Friday.
Is she?
She's pretty good looking.
Okay.
No.
Chuck did good.
No. Yeah, he did do good.
She had a hunch about him. She had a third sense about these things.
You know what he said? He goes, she probably said, okay, what do you do? I work for the state's office.
No, she even knows he's a loser.
He works for the state.
She even knows that.
He's got a good job.
Yeah. I'm happy he's happy.
Is he?
No.
I'm going to start stirring the pot on this relationship early.
Yeah, listen.
I'm going to get this over with. I think. First of all,
you're just like
I don't know
me.
If I'm even allowed to talk about this, but they might have plenty of fish. Strike one, strike two, and strike, I'll give it 2.5.
Well, she's a good,
okay?
She's a good Christian girl.
No, she's probably Jeffrey Dahmer. One, okay? So they might have plenty of fish. Second of all, who's Chuck to be in a relationship? That's just...
Christian equals moral.
You know his mom and dad are...
Hey, listen, God bless. Hope it works out. It's not going to work
Chuck,
out. It's,
Chuck, you're getting older. Are you going to settle down with some nice girl?
Oh, well...
Once she hears anything he says on this show...
I'm speaking out of school, but... His parents were at his roommates were at town
his, oh,
this
his roommates.
Weekend.
Yeah, his roommates.
His roommates were in Florida, and he tried to get her to come back to the house, and she wouldn't have none of it. And I'm like, so you just announced that your boyfriend, girlfriend, and she still won't fuck you. We knew he liked her, though, because they went out like 5 times, and he wasn't getting any. Oh, he got to like second base like once.
Does he tell her, I do this podcast occasionally, and she's like... Oh, you're really good on the podcast when you had that story about banging a girl in a parking garage.
She doesn't listen.
Anal
to
okay.
Anal beads.
Yeah. I don't think anyone lets any women they're interested in listen to this show.
Yeah.
Does your woman listen to it? I know you're seeing abroad. Are you still seeing her?
No. She's getting married to that guy.
Wait. This broad you were seeing is getting married?
Yeah.
What is with you and broads that are on the verge of marriage?
I don't know, but they go
like
for
your
me.
Thing.
I've
and you get really excited about it.
I've
like
had
each time it's going to be the difference maker.
I've had quite a few women cheat on their men with me.
Yeah,
it's really weird.
This is how it goes. I'm about to get married, and I'm going to try a Greek before I get married.
That's what they're thinking.
Oh boy.
So I don't even understand. I don't understand. So she's getting married. She just how does this work? Do they just call you up and say,
so
Lee,
No,
yeah.
I found out from someone else, which, you know, that was kind of rough.
I thought I was
why
in a sticky
everything
situation.
That happens on this show like Maury Povich?
I don't know.
Everyone's life on this show is
and
like,
it's not your baby daddy.
Yeah.
I told you, bitch.
I would do that
you
dance.
You weren't that lucky,
we should start giving people paternity tests.
Maury said it's yours.
We should start giving our guys paternity tests and lie detector tests.
We should sign up.
I don't
Alex
know, but I'm
Maury.
Over it. I'm over it. You know.
Yeah.
There's gonna be
all
like there's gonna be like 7 black guys and then me. They're gonna
listen.
They're gonna...
I'm not busting your balls.
No.
I'm just more curious of how. I think the question every listener in the world wants to know is how does a broad break it up with you when she's going to marry her fiance?
Well. Then it's like, that's a serious thing, and they're like, we can't be doing this anymore.
Oh, that's what it is?
She hasn't said that, but it's like, I can infer that. That ring, it has a special power.
And then...
It turns things absolute. It makes things...
Remember the masseuse I was seeing in L.A.?
Yeah, which one?
The one that was in school.
Uh-huh.
Found out, because that's my new thing, hunting down masseuses in school. Found out afterwards... In a, like, 10-year relationship, and we were cheating.
Huh.
I did not know going in. I felt like on Ray Donovan, I felt like the brother. I did. I felt like the brother.
Yeah.
By the way, how amazing is that show?
It's great. How good is the cast? They got Eddie.
How great's Voight?
Voight is outstanding.
He's seriously the best. He made me cry in the season
finale.
Oh,
the last
season? I'm not even kidding.
Yeah, in the gym?
In the season finale in the gym, he made me cry.
I know the scene you mean. It's great.
He made me cry. I've not cried watching TV, maybe in my life. I can't even think of a moment where I cried watching TV.
Yeah.
That's how good John Voight is in this show.
Yeah, he's
how amazing.
He's terrific. First few shows.
You don't like Voight on Ray Donovan? Are you out of your fucking mind?
The first few shows, you're like, oh, he's doing sort of this goofy character. And then the character really grows on you. He's such a sad character.
I think he's trying too hard.
Oh, no.
Are you out of your mind?
I'm sorry.
That's his character, trying too hard.
Trying too hard.
That's his character.
He's trying too hard to trying too hard.
Oh, no. You know, someone said to me, oh, it's a scenery chewing role. No. This guy makes the cake.
He's a real
bakes
character.
Bakes the cake. And eats the cake.
Yeah.
Like, this is a whole fucking thing. You want to see scenery chewing? I can name 10 Al Pacino performances way more scenery chewing than this.
Right.
I don't think he's chewing scenery at all, honestly.
I think he's chewing a little.
Oh, my God. I so disagree.
How is he chewing scenery if it takes place in Hollywood and they have Boston accents?
Yeah.
They look out of
place. By the way, he's the best Boston accent on the show.
Right. He's great.
Who's better?
I don't know. It's just something about it.
Oh.
I think everyone else is awesome.
His relationship with Bunchy is amazing.
It is great.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The guy's great. And that has...
When he found out he killed the wrong priest, for real,
yeah.
And Bunchy tells him,
yeah.
We got the real one, and he's just like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
It's so great.
It's great.
And the relationship he has with Rosanna Arquette
is So fantastic. Sad. What happens to her is so sad.
So sad. But
how,
like,
they meet is so funny.
Oh,
and
my
it
God.
Just goes so wrong.
At the spa?
And you, oh. Yeah. And you really think he's a scumbag until they bring in Jimmy Woods, who's an even bigger scumbag.
The worst.
The worst.
And by the way, yeah. I was expecting Jimmy to overact, and he didn't.
No, he was great.
He didn't at all.
And
my favorite scene
and
with
Woods.
And
he's full of hate, so he probably wrote his own dialogue.
My favorite scene, my favorite scene with Woods is when the three hitmen are just eating the Subways on the bed.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's so good.
That's so good.
It's such a good scene.
And I love, personally, I'm a huge fan of Eddie Marson.
Oh,
and
great.
I love Brooke Smith.
Great.
She's so underrated.
By the way, Brooke Smith is someone that at first you feel like maybe is going to be a little over the top.
Yeah.
Never gets that way.
No, she's great.
That show is so pitch perfect. I don't know if it's the directing on it. I don't know what the deal is. But all those actors are, like, right on.
Yeah.
And by the way, Voight's so good, and his role is flashy, like Luisi said.
Right.
But that's what Luisi's forgetting. His role's written flashy. Liev Schreiber's role's not as flashy. So Liev is sort of, even though he's the star of the show, kind of under the radar how good he is on it.
Right.
Because he's kind of the anchor. He never goes over the top,
no.
Ever, Liev.
Right.
And he has moments where he could. Like when he hits Voight with the gun, when
yeah.
He puts the gun to his head and he hits him. Like, Liev could have gone crazy with that.
Yeah.
He was kind of calm
and
scary.
Oh, on the lawn?
Yeah.
When they had the party?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the scenes he has with the girl, the actress, that wants to fuck him real bad.
Uh-huh.
And then they do hook up. The one that wants to keep hooking up with them. That,
right.
From the pilot.
Yeah.
Those scenes could be over the top. He never goes there.
Right.
He's so good, Liev Schreiber.
It's really good.
Yeah. How do you not like... You like the show?
I love the show. The show is phenomenal. I think... The scenes that he's in...
Talking to the mic.
The scenes that he's in, I think...
I want to hear this bullshit. Go ahead.
Just, I see him in all these other movies and these bigger roles. You kind of don't see him portrayed in that.
Voight?
Yeah. I don't know. It just throws me off a little bit, seeing him like that. What is that?
You don't talk loud enough. I got to turn it up, goofball. You talk like a...
I'm not like Terzo. I don't want to hear myself.
Well, I want to. I'd at least like to hear you. I don't care about our listeners who are like, who's that soft voice in the background?
All right, we just creamed over this show, but the point is it's a really good show.
I tend to cream over very few shows,
yeah.
Oh, and that's one I'm definitely
very good.
Oh,
cream,
so
cream it over
great
there.
On the show. Great on the show. And I wanted to say it was great because I've met him. I kind of know him. My friend is, like, best friends with him, Stephen Bauer.
Yeah.
However,
right.
I watched the show. And he's legit great. Like, this isn't me blowing him. He's legit great.
Yeah, yeah.
How he pulls off that Lebanese character, which, by the way, he's nothing like in real life.
Right.
Like, not at all. He's really fucking good.
Yeah.
Really, really fucking good. Yeah. So that's a good character, too. And I love the broad from The L Word
yeah.
That plays his assistant.
Yeah, right.
She's outstanding.
She's really good.
In limited shit.
Yeah.
They barely give her anything to do until the season finale.
She's
great.
She's a real character.
She's great.
Yeah.
I love the scene. And this is a show that I love, too, because it is not about talking. It's about showing.
Right.
For instance, we don't know she's a lesbian right away. I'll find out that she's a lesbian, that she's in a relationship, that she's being cheated on. She shows up to this woman's office and just punches her in the fucking face.
Yeah.
And we get it.
We
do.
Yeah.
Right there. Right. Everything that happened.
That's good writing.
And that's what I love about this show.
Yeah.
They're like, we don't have to sit and explain the exposition to you for a full episode.
That's the thing where I watch some shows and I'm just like, man, I will never be able to write that good.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought of that.
Put
I would have had
way.
Them talking. I wouldn't have had them doing stuff.
In Hollywood, they would tell you in the first episode, leave it all out on the table because you may not have a second, right? This is a show that did not tell you in the first episode why him and John Voight have a bad relationship. We have Schreiber and John Voight.
Right.
You don't find out for, like, during the whole season. It just goes small bits and pieces throughout the season.
Yeah.
And most of it is shown, not told. Then, we don't know how his sister dies in the first episode.
No.
That is something
right.
They would have told you in any WGA class, in any writing class, in any studio meeting. They would have said, no, you got to leave it all out there. Why'd the sister die? They don't really tell you until, like, the third or fourth episode.
Right.
I mean, it's so good. It's so good.
There's too much plotting in a lot of shows. Too much plot.
And that's why I love this show. It lets you you find out
some
when they
the
want
plots,
you to
some
find
some of the
out.
Plots are ingenious, but there's yep. too much of it.
Yeah. So what's my next show I got to watch?
A lot of new stuff. Well,
by the way, Justified's been great this
Justified's
year.
Justified's been good.
I didn't watch last
I've
night.
I've been following True Detective.
Okay, I need to watch that. Is it really good?
It's really good. I wish it was a little less indebted to Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
But,
which, by the way, the creator gives no credit to.
Yeah.
He says there's nothing to that.
Yeah, well.
He's full of shit.
That being said.
Huh?
Rake?
I mean, I love Peter Tolan, but. I don't think that show's going to last long. The ratings are bad. Kinnear, too. He's never been a star.
No.
Right.
This is one of those things, again, where I don't know what the network's thinking when they're like, we have to give him a huge payday,
well,
but let's cast
Greg Kinnear.
Well,
he's starred in movies and been good in them.
But he's never been box office.
He's right. been good so far. I mean,
yeah, but he's never been box office. So I never get why these networks are like, yeah, you hire Greg Kinnear, but you don't pay him $200,000 an episode.
Yeah.
He's not worth that. He's not worth it.
Uh-huh.
So then when the ratings come in average to below average, the show has no shot because the budget's already through the roof because you're paying Kinnear out the ass.
Right.
That's how those things work. That's why, I mean, I love Peter Tolan, but my main criticism for Peter, and I don't know if I've told him this or not, is he likes to align himself with big stars to get shows made, which is great.
Which is...
But you have to pay big stars big money. So if they start out slow, you're fucked.
Well, I think the two is you know, the advertisement.
Into the
too.
Mic, Luisi. Into the mic.
The advertisement. I don't think they advertise enough to really
Rake. They advertised all year. It was a mid-season show. They've been advertising it since the end of summer.
Okay.
And it got huge Super Bowl advertising. So I'm fascinated to see how it does this week.
I think it'll do better. I think it'll catch. It's one of those shows that it started slow,
like
that
the
will catch on.
Okay, but the following. Here's my point. The following. Kevin Bacon. Is a star. Like Kevin Bacon more than Greg Kinnear. It's just a fact.
Oh, yeah.
People rather watch a show with Kevin Bacon than right. Greg Kinnear. Greg Kinnear is a really, really great character actor.
How many degrees of things connect to Greg Kinnear?
Right. He's a great character actor, but he's not a lead. He's not a lead. Kevin Bacon, even though he's done mostly character acting, is a lead. He has lead in him. Because women love him.
He has his own.
I mean, it's as simple as
he has his own band, for Christ's sake.
Women love him.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
what it is. It's as flat out as easy as that. Bacon's a great actor, and guys like him, but women love him.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
why Kiefer Sutherland made it on TV. It's not just guys that watch 24. Women like Kiefer
no.
for whatever reason.
He's dangerous.
Let me tell you something.
Sexual.
He was a very nice guy.
He was very nice to you.
I
yeah,
worked
I know.
In a group with him. Yeah, he's a real nice guy.
Yeah, no, and I hear that. He just gets. Banned from every bar in town.
Yeah.
He literally has to drive to, like, Pasadena to hang out
now. He does.
Now.
If
yeah.
he stays on the wagon, he's
I like Pasadena.
I love Pasadena. Lee and I had a blast in Pasadena.
Loved
I'd
it.
Go there all the time. I
Blastadena.
Yeah, Blastadena. That's right.
Dina.
So Lee and I are very good at, we could go to, like, Dubuque and have a good time.
Find fun.
Yeah, because our expectations are low. Or people's expectations for fun are way too high.
Well, our ability to have fun in the L.A. area, in the greater L.A. area, was based on the fact of our just saying, hey, this is not WeHo.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, I'm happy, though, just going to a fucking bar with pool tables. And shooting stick.
Oh, yeah.
That's, like, fun for me, with, like, a good burger down the block.
Absolutely.
And we found a bar that has the good burger upstairs, and then you go downstairs,
at the
and
pool.
You get mugs for beer. Like, were they 24 ounces?
They were big, and I wanted to go there with you and do some serious drinking, because I couldn't go on my own, but we never did, but that's okay.
That's a good joint, though. That's a good joint.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got great food in Pasadena. I love Pasadena.
Yeah.
Very underrated Pasadena. And, Glendale, there's nothing going on there, really. And they lie to you about how late their Mexican joints are open till.
Yeah, that's right.
What?
Fuckers.
It's on the sign.
Oh, they're fucking liars there about their fucking Mexican joints.
People get shot in Chicago over that stuff.
My favorite is the angry guy in Pasadena that sells the breakfast burritos.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Greek guy.
Lucky Boy.
Yeah, Lucky Boy.
And Southern California's only Greek guy.
And he's like the angriest Greek guy you'll meet in California.
And Lee.
We're giving him money, and he's like,
you want sausage, bacon, or ham? Okay. Oh, you want salsa too, eh?
And then I asked for salsa, and Lee asked for salsa, and when I asked for salsa, he goes, oh, yes, okay.
Okay.
Then Lee asked, and he goes, oh.
Yeah.
He Greeked it up. He Greeked it up for the Greek. He got Greeker.
Cheeseburger. It is a great breakfast burrito.
This is obscene.
This breakfast burrito is like the size of your head, and it weighs like 3 pounds.
Nobody gets anything else there late at night because it's all drunk college.
It's probably like 8 eggs in the burrito.
Cash only, too.
Yeah.
You're the asshole, Greek guy, not us asking for salsa.
Right.
You're the asshole.
Cash only.
Cash only.
ATM inside. No Coke, Pepsi.
RC.
Well, let's play the interview with Vivek since we didn't talk Broadway at all. But to give you a rundown, this is how big he is. Of course, The Fifth Beatles, a graphic novel, and the movie coming out that we're going to be talking about, directed by Peyton Reed.
My mom wanted to know, were they going to get Benedict Cumberbatch to play him?
Question I did not ask. Oh. That's a good one, though. That's a very good one.
She heard that.
Oh, she heard it?
Well, she heard
her.
She heard about
Cumberbatch
it.
Fan
she has a file called. She has a file called Cumberwatch.
I literally think your mom goes to fan sites for Benedict Cumberbatch.
I think she does.
I think
it's
so.
It's their hobby. It's
great.
A nice thing.
They got tons on GeoCities, I'm sure. that's a good question, though.
Yeah.
I can ask him and find out next week. I can hit him up.
You don't have to.
Hit him up. Hit him up.
He just emailed me today. Cool
okay,
guy. So Vivek produced American Idiot, the musical, Green Day, the Addams Family Values musical, or the Addams Family, I don't know which one it is. It's the first one, not the movie.
Addams Family.
Addams Family Values was the sequel to the movie.
Was a sequel.
Which
was
incredible.
Awesome. Which is
incredible.
One of the best sequels of the 90s.
The scene where Raul Julia goes to the police station and confronts Nathan Lane behind the counter, and he's trying to talk about the freaks that have taken over his house. One of the funniest things I've ever seen in cinema.
The whole
and Raul Julia is so fucking good.
Well, you like
she's good
when you watch.
Good.
Yeah, she's good.
Yeah, Raul Julia, she is good.
That movie. Once they get to the summer camp,
Lee can't even comment on it.
Once they get to the summer camp, that movie is the most mean spirited attack on sunny middle brow American values.
It's great.
I've seen since Gremlins.
No, what is your feelings on the fantastic actress Raul Julia? do you love her as much as Alex?
I do. He was great as the Spider Woman in Kiss of the Spider Woman.
And what a great lawyer and presumed innocent that they decided to cast a woman in that role was.
They
just,
decided
I
to cast
Asian.
A woman as M. Bison.
Yeah, right. Yeah, as M. Bison.
Oh boy.
Have you figured it out yet?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We laid it on pretty thick.
It has your man Angelica Houston in it.
Yeah. That brings us back to Angelica.
Yeah.
And he's phenomenal.
Yeah.
By the way, how hot is she as Morticia Adams?
Yeah, I kind of like...
How underrated is she?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
She really was like really sexy in that movie.
How hot is she in Prizzy's Honor?
Yeah.
Like, why didn't she get... I don't understand this at all. Angelica Houston.
And I got to give it to her because she blasts Hollywood for not giving women good roles.
I'm going
to
say this
deeply
right now,
appreciate that.
And I mean this. She's way better than Jessica Lange.
Yes.
Throwing
it
out there.
All right.
Listen, I like Jessica Lange, kind of.
Okay.
Kind of. But I don't think Jessica Lange's even in the same league as Angelica Houston.
Okay.
It's not even close to me. Could you... I can name... Put it this way. I can name 5 great Angelica Houston roles like that. Jessica Lange, I'd be sitting here for 10 minutes.
Okay.
I'd probably have to go through her IMDb.
Okay.
Can you name 5 great Jessica Lange movies?
Okay, you're good.
Hush,
yeah.
By the way, is Hush the worst movie ever? Her and Gwyneth Paltrow?
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's not even just a bad script. It's poorly edited. It's poorly directed. It's like the worst movie. It's really bad.
She's kind of a poor man's... Glenn Close, maybe.
That's good. Yeah, that's good. You know,
she's good.
When I was a kid, I used to get her and Lauren Hutton confused.
Oh, yeah? Oh.
Yeah. Because they look pretty similar in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
With the long, curly, blonde locks.
Blonde.
The only thing with Lauren Hutton with the gap between her teeth. Lauren Hutton's gorgeous.
I'm very much into the blonde wasp look.
Me too. Farrah Fawcett and
Fawcett,
Dr. T and the women.
Candice Bergen when she was young.
Get
out of here.
How much did you love Farrah Fawcett
Martha
and
Stewart.
Dr. T and the women?
Oh, yeah. She's Farrah Fawcett.
How great
the scene
is she
in the mall?
In
yeah,
oh,
she was looking good.
When she's naked in the fountain. Yeah, but how great does she look in that movie?
Yeah, that was good.
She was ageless till the cancer. She was perfect. She was.
I know that sounds, but yeah, you're right. Yes.
She was. Farrah Fawcett never aged.
Yeah.
Ever. She was so gorgeous. And who else? Morgan Fairchild was like the TV version of those women.
And Morgan.
And Suzanne Summers.
Morgan Fairchild never did anything for me.
Not me either.
Yeah.
I mean, who did I love on TV? None of those broads. Those Joan Collins broads.
Yeah.
I was never really into them. I was never into Dynasty.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You like Dynasty? Kyan likes it?
Say a thing.
You're too young for Dynasty. You're my age almost.
Well, you go Dynasty and he's like,
Yeah, I saw. That's why I'm like, have a comment on your little...
Oh, that was him. That was Luisi that said that. You're right.
You like Dynasty?
No, I was just thinking we should probably start the interview.
He loved Dallas because it's about his family.
Right.
The Ewing Luisis.
He probably thinks Dynasty is Dallas.
Yeah, that's probably true, too.
Sounds like a porno.
Your family kind of is like Downers Grove Dallas. A little bit. You never watched Dallas? You didn't get that reference at all?
No. Right over my head.
Okay. It's about the Ewings. They're like a family in Dallas, Texas.
So they have money? Is that what you're saying?
There's more to it.
Okay.
Oh, he's so insulted. You better start the interview.
So Vivek did Adam's Family, American Idiot, The Producers, Young
right,
Frankenstein.
So we insulted Luisi, Chuck. Who else?
Yeah,
here
right.
or not?
Yeah,
Terzo's
right.
not. We're... Hit Terza with something.
We'll get him when we come back.
We'll get him when we get everybody.
But here's Vivek Tiwari. You're going to have to listen to my pregame as well.
I can't wait for this.
This is going to be a fucking...
I'm taking off my headphones because I'm so embarrassed I didn't...
That's Matthew Aaron, P.O. Box.
He has a P.O. Box.
Yeah, that's right.
He does.
Actually, we do have a P.O. Box, Anthony and I. Anthony and I share a P.O. Box, so I think we can file for domestic partnership.
Aww.
I think so, right?
Aww.
If you have a P.O. box, that's like a good enough... Like,
oh, yeah. I'm ordained.
Well, now everyone knows it's a lie, though.
Get to the interview! I have a sinus infection, and I want to hear Vivek talk about the Fifth Beatle!
All right, Pat Tobias.
Pat, I still need to meet you.
If you bring Pizza Hut to the movie set, he will follow. If you buy it, they will come.
They will come.
Okay, here we go, Vivek.
If you fry it...
This is Matthew Aaron here with Vivek Tiwari on the Matthew Aaron Show. I'm very excited.
Oh,
I did it right.
Let's
talk about the Fifth Beatle.
Good work.
All right. This graphic novel, which if you've not read it, is so hot, it's being developed. I mean, are you in pre-production on this film already for the film version?
We are going to be cast. We're starting the casting process in just a few weeks, so we're just about to get going in serious pre-production.
So,
yeah,
right.
Very exciting. Screenplay's done and casting's beginning soon.
You're in between that development pre-production stage, that very very
I guess so, yeah.
stage. Yes. So what I was going to ask you is, first of all, the script for the film, and we're going to bounce around here, but the script for the film. Now, as I understand it, you wrote a script for the graphic novel as well, though, right? So how different is writing a script for a graphic novel and a script for a film based off of Brian Epstein, the famed manager of the Beatles, the Fifth Beatle?
Yeah, it is a very different process. You know, the two mediums are obviously have a lot of overlap, which is why you see a lot of film adaptations of graphic novels as well as you know, comic and graphic novel adaptations of films, because the two mediums do share a lot of similarities, but they really are different mediums. You know, one incredibly obvious example is that on the film you have the ability to incorporate sound. And one of the most exciting pieces of news for our film is that we have the approval of the Beatles, the sign-off on our screenplay, which has allowed us to do a deal with Sony ATV, who control the music publishing, which is a very long-winded way of saying we have access to Beatles music for the film. So one obvious example is, you know, since we have access to that music, you can be sure we're going to use it.
Right.
So there's quite a number of music sequences in the film that you won't see in the book. While the book does have a few of those sequences, the book obviously can't break out into song. And so while I think the artist did a tremendous job of capturing the feel of the music in those moments where we do have music scenes. You know, we wanted to limit those in the book, whereas in the film I had much more leeway to include a greater number of those. So so it is different, and I would say the word I also use to describe the film is, you know, adaptation is the easy word, but it really is more of an expansion on the story.
Yeah.
You know, it uses the graphic novel as a base, and it does have that sort of look and feel, but it allows me to tell certain stories and certain, you know, elements of the Brian Epstein story that I couldn't tell in the book. And similarly, the book has a number of sequences that aren't in the film. So I hope for people who are interested in the Fifth Beatle, by experiencing both, they'll just get a much rounder, fuller picture of the Brian Epstein story.
Well, it was interesting you said how you try to capture music as well in the graphic novel, which I think you do very well. I mean, I guess
thank
the
you.
Tricks to that, and I mean the artist does as well. Alan Robertson, is that it?
Andrew Robertson.
I'm sorry. Okay, Andrew Robertson.
No, it's okay.
What I meant to ask you, though, was when you guys are trying to capture the music in the graphic novel, was it both your ideas to come up with the bubbles and the fonts that you use? When you're making a graphic novel, I guess, what I'm trying to ask you is, from coming from a Broadway guy and a film guy like yourself, how do you respond to, you know, bringing out emotion in the scenes? Do you use the different fonts? Obviously, you do in this book.
Yeah, you know, I'm a longtime comic book fan. I've been reading comics ever since I was a little kid. I often joke around that I probably learned to read by reading comics. So, I mean, you know, this is certainly my first graphic novel as an author, but it's a medium I'm very, very familiar with. And you know, I'm also one of those geeks that buys the special edition of you know, famous books, and that comes with 20 pages of the script, and I will compare the script to the book. And so, you know, the script is a form that I was very comfortable with, and it is a very collaborative process between myself and the artist. And there's also, you know, a letterer, and the Steve Dutro, who is our letterer, that was his job, was to, you know, to do the bubbles and the captions that you're referring to. And so it was a collaborative process. I would say that I want something special for music lyrics. I want something that, you know, looks a little bit fanciful, but, you know, I don't want to just put a few musical notes above to indicate that there are lyrics. That's a little cheesy. And then Steve would send me three different possibilities, and I would say, I like this one, but it's not perfect. Or could it be a little bit less, you know, psychedelic? And then he'd come back with something else. And, you know, we'd just kind of go back and forth. But it really was something that we spent, you know, a meticulous amount of attention on, both myself, Andrew, and the letterer, even, you know, down to fonts and balloon styles. And you'll notice the telephone has a certain style. The radio
right.
has a certain style. The music lyrics have a certain style. You know, there's a character named Moxie, and, you know, her captions have a certain style to indicate that she's speaking. And, you know, there's quite a bit of nuances in the lettering, and all of that was very well thought out.
No, it's like you give character to all these things, which is great, just by the way you design it.
Thanks.
I was going to ask you also about, we were talking about the lettering and everything. And you were talking about your history with comics and graphic novels. And what graphic novels do you think have inspired you that you came up with the concept of doing The Fifth Beatle as a graphic novel?
You know, I don't know that there's any particular number or particular book or books that inspired me, to tell this story as a graphic novel. You know, it's just that when I started to construct when I decided that I wanted to tell the Brian Epstein story, you know, my first thought was, you know, okay, I want to tell this story. You know, what's the right medium for it? And as I started to structure it, I realized I wanted to focus on the last 7 years of his life, which is the time he spent with the Beatles, you know, through exposition and backstory and hallucinations and dream sequences and that sort of thing. We do get a taste of his earlier life and kind of a sense of what makes him tick as a person, but it really does focus on those last 7 years. So the story starts in 1961 Liverpool, which is very dark, gray, drab, industrial. You know, I viewed it as being very black and white. And the story ends in 1967 London, which is the summer of love. It's the psychedelic era. It's quite literally a technicolor dream is the way I thought of it. And so, you know, I know this sounds awfully esoteric, but to me as a creator, the arc of the Brian Epstein story sort of mirrored the arc of the movement from black and white to color. And, you know, whether that makes any sense or not, I don't know. But you can definitely tell that I was thinking in terms of color palette. And to me, when you think in terms of color palette like that, that is a graphic novel and a film, which are the two mediums, I think, that visually, you know, play with color palette the most. And so that's, you know, we really did set about doing both from the beginning. So, you know, that's kind of how I came to the idea of doing it as a graphic novel. You know, the specific books that have inspired me over the ages, you know, I love Chris Claremont's run on the X-Men. You know, that was very seminal for me when I was a kid growing up. And then some of the more quote-unquote serious work, Frank Miller's Ronin and The Dark Knight was very influential to me. Neil Gaiman's The Sandman was very influential. Alan Moore's work has been, you know, also very seminal for me. So I would say those are some of my favorites, but I can't necessarily say that any of those books directly led to The Fifth Beetle. I think it's more that the medium itself made sense.
No, I was going to say, if the Dark Phoenix saga or Days of Future Past led to The Fifth Beetle.
You know, I mean, indirectly so. You know, I mean,
sure.
Those two sagas, without question, you know, had a huge impact in opening my mind to what comics could be.
Right.
You know, I mean, I was a huge fan of comics even before those. As I said, I've been reading since I was a little kid. But when you get to the Dark Phoenix saga and Days of Future Past, you just sort of realize, like, comics are as high a literary art form as any.
Well,
you know, and not terribly unlike the way Brian Epstein first thought that, you know, the Beatles will elevate pop music into an art form. You know, pop music and high art aren't as far away as they may seem. And to me, Claremont's run on the X-Men is what proved that, you know, that artistic sort of sense of the potential of comics. You know, it's
right.
not really that far off.
No, and he changed the game forever, Chris Claremont.
No doubt.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to talk to you, because you're a very visual guy. I mean, even the musicals that you produce are incredibly visual. Like, you got big productions.
Thank you.
They're big productions. So, like, I thought this made sense to do as a graphic novel, and now as a film, what is going to be the difference, do you think, in the tone between the film and the graphic novel?
You know, I hope that it's going to be quite similar. You know, I've written the screenplay, so I can tell you that it definitely has, you know, the same sort of look and feel to it. Peyton Reed is our director, and you know,
great.
Peyton's amazing, and
yeah.
I definitely want him to, you know, to have his you know, he's an auteur, and I want to make sure that he's able to put his own stamp on the piece. You know, that being said, he's a huge fan of the graphic novel, and part of the reason we attached Peyton to the project is that we do share a similar vision for it. So I hope it will have the same sort of tone that the book has, you know, something that is overall, you know, obviously a very serious story, and one that I hope is inspiring at the end of the day, although it is also tragic. But there are obviously also a lot of moments of lighthearted whimsy, as the Beatles were lighthearted and whimsical in many ways. You know, and it will have, you know, the sort of fantastical sequences that the book has, you know, delving into hallucination sequences and dream sequences and having a healthy dose of fantasy, if you will. And the film has all of that. So on one hand, we're not using the graphic novel as a set of storyboards for the film. The film will be its own thing. But on the other hand, you know, if you're a fan of the graphic novel, I think you'll be very pleased with the way we're treating it.
No, that's great. Of course, it's the best-selling graphic novel. Tons of people have already gotten it. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, when you called it The Fifth Beetle, did anyone say Billy Preston?
No, you know, it's funny that Billy Preston is certainly a name that pops up from time to time associated with The Fifth Beetle, but,
sure.
You know, it's more so that, like, that people just had other questions about, you know, isn't The Fifth Beetle Stu Sutcliffe, who was the band's original bass
sure.
player? Isn't it George Martin, who was their producer? Isn't it Neil Aspinall, who was their best friend and ran Apple for a number of years? Is it Billy Preston? You know, there's a number of people who
right.
who have their own feelings as to who deserves the title The Fifth Beetle. You know, I'm going with Paul McCartney, who said if anyone was the Fifth Beetle, it was Brian. And you know, that's sort of a, you know, an easy way to put it. But I also think that, you know, Brian, without Brian, you know, we're about to celebrate the band's 50th anniversary in the United States, arriving in the United States. And the truth is, without Brian, they would never have come to the United States. You know, Ed Sullivan didn't want to book the band. It's a fallacy it's a piece of misinformation that Sullivan was hot on the Beatles. You know, he booked the band several months before their arrival here. And at the time there were nobodies over here, and Ryan had to practically twist his arm into that. It's dramatized in the book. You know, and so Brian's, you know, his importance to bringing the world of the Beatles simply cannot be understated. And to me, that's the fifth part of the band. You know, there's a line in the book where Brian says, you know, you play your instruments and I'll play the business as my instrument. And that's the best way I can think of putting it. You know, playing the business, you know, is an integral part of the success of any piece of art. You know, as is the artist, art itself. And so to me, if anyone is deserving of the title, you know, Fifth Beatle, it really is Brian.
Yeah.
I guess Paul McCartney agrees with me. So that's
well,
pretty good,
that's
right?
Well, that's a good team for you to side on. Here's the thing. If you don't mind me talking about how amazing Brian's story is for a minute and why this is such a – this story resonates with now, if you ask me as well. Brian was a Jewish gay man from Liverpool, okay? This was back in, like, what, 62, 61? I believe it was a felony to be gay in Liverpool. I believe
That's right.
being
yep.
Jewish was not too popular. And yeah. on top of it, Brian finds this band that he says are going to be bigger than Elvis, okay? And this is a man... So it's just crazy right off the bat, right? This guy is like
yeah.
an outsider who's just he's, and there's nothing about him where people are going to rally around him because of his ethnicities and background and whatever. And he says this band's going to be bigger than fucking Elvis. And then he ends up dying at 32 years old, and he's a lonely guy in this process. So I mean, this is an amazing story, and I'm going to ask you, but I'm also assuming, if you don't mind me doing something stupid and assuming for a moment, was
no,
there
please.
An outsider quality to Brian that led you to relate to his story? Because obviously, for you to be as passionate to do all these interviews and to see this project through graphic novel to now film, to write the screenplay, to write the graphic novel, to produce these things, you are obviously very, very, very connected to this story. What personally brings you to this story?
Yeah, well, you really nailed it. You know, I initially came to the story as a lifelong Beatles fan, and I discovered Brian's story 21 years ago when I was in business school. I went to the Wharton School of Business, and I was studying and dreaming about working in entertainment, and I tend to be a little academic, so I thought I should study the lives of the great entertainment visionaries. So I initially got interested in the Brian Epstein story for the reason that most people are attracted to learning about it, because of the Beatles, you know, wanting to know, you know, how he came up with the suits and the haircuts and how he, you know, convinced a record label to sign them when no one wanted to sign the Beatles, how he convinced Ed Sullivan to bring them over here, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And it's a great story, and that's all in the book, and that's all very well and good. But it's exactly what you were getting at, the human side of his story that struck a very deep chord for me. You know, Brian, in my mind, really was the ultimate outsider and a bit of a misfit in his chosen field, you know, being gay at a time when it was a felony, being Jewish at a time when anti-Semitism was rampant in the country, and quite frankly, being from Liverpool at a time in 1961 where the town had no cultural influence to speak of. You know, so here was this gay Jewish man running around Liverpool saying, I found a local band. They're going to be bigger than Elvis. They're going to elevate pop music to an art form. You know, he was crazy. And he had this dream that seemed impossible, but it was a beautiful dream. And he realized it spectacularly, obviously, and the world got a result. And for me, you know, I'm a first-generation American. My family's from Guyana, South America, by way of India. And, you know, while I'm not the only one of my background doing what I do, we are a rare breed. You know, people of my background and my ethnicity are typically steered into fields like medicine, engineering, technology, straightforward business, you know, industries. You know, we're not... you know, encouraged to do graphic novels and produce Broadway,
yep.
You know, so I could really relate to that sense of feeling like a bit of an outsider in your chosen field. And I really don't want to suggest that I've had the obstacles in my life that Brian has had. I mean, he had it, you know, it was really quite awful what he had to face, being told that his sexuality was illegal, you know, so I really don't want to claim that the parallels are exact, but nevertheless, I could sort of emotionally relate to the personal struggles in Brian's life, and you know, his chasing that dream and believing that, you know, his mission to help bring this band whose message was all about love to spread that message all around the globe. I find that very beautiful and very inspiring. And, you know, in my career, to have a lot of people tell me, you know, people like you don't do these sorts of things. And for me to feel a little bit like an outsider in my chosen fields, you know, having Brian Epstein as a model to teach me that it's worth daring to dream, for lack of another way of putting it, has been incredibly inspiring.
Yeah, I think a bunch of your Broadway productions would show that you have some attraction to that outsider quality as well. Everything ranging from the Addams Family to Green Day. I mean,
so
I think there is a little bit of that into your work, and you should be proud of that. You should wear that on your sleeve. Let me ask you about some of your Broadway work. How did you get involved in Broadway, where obviously you've been so successful? And what does it take to put together one of these productions?
Well, I grew up in New York City. I was born here. I grew up on 12th Street. And ever since I was a little kid, my parents, who were great lovers of the arts, were taking me uptown to Lincoln Center and Times Square. And I was seeing opera and ballet and Broadway shows and, you know, the finer arts, if you will. And then as soon as I was allowed out of the house on my own, I was going downtown to places like CBGB's and the Old Ritz and La Mama. And, you know, back then, every other storefront, you know, when the sun went down, was either turned itself into a rock club or an experimental theater house. So it was a wonderful time to be exposed to the arts, and I grew up loving it all. I grew up loving the Broadway uptown and punk rock downtown, you know, and I'm proud of all my productions, but in some ways, you know, American Idiot has a special place in my heart because it really was the sort of combination of two interests that as a child seemed very disparate. You know, because I grew up sort of loving all the art forms, I knew that I wanted to work, you know, cross-platform. I wanted to work in theater, film, television, music, the whole bit. While I was in business school, I was working for Sony Music as a field marketing rep, so my background goes back to the music industry. And after I graduated, I moved back to New York City, which was home, and I took a job working at Mercury Records, division of PolyGram, where I was for about 3 years until Seagram's bought PolyGram and merged it with Universal, and budgets were frozen, and everyone was miserable. And, you know, and I had this long-time dream to start my own company. I won't bore you with my family history unless you want to talk about that a little later, but I will just briefly say my grandfather was a very successful entrepreneur, and he always told me, you need to do what you love, and you need to work for yourself. And I knew I loved all the art forms, not just music, and my goal was to work for myself. So at that moment, when everybody was miserable at Mercury, I left and I started my own company, and I called it Tiwari Entertainment Group, giving it that vague name because I knew I wanted to work in mediums outside of the traditional music industry. And then I put word out to my contact base that I was looking to get involved in other art forms. In particular, I was thinking theater and Broadway because I was living here in New York and Broadway was in my backyard. And I joined a project to open up a Broadway Hall of Fame, which ended up not happening. But through that project, I met some of the lead producers of the producers, the Mel Brooks musical, and they invited me to come on board that show. And I did, and that was the show that I learned the ropes from. I really learned how to produce by having a small part of that show, and that show was tremendously successful. And so I sort of found myself off to the races. I then wound up having a small piece of Hairspray. I was lead producer of A Raisin in the Sun, and you know the rest. I was involved in the Addams Family, American Idiot, and right now I'm working very closely with Alanis Morissette to adapt her album Jagged Little Pill for the Broadway stage. So that's my next theater project.
That is so awesome. I got to ask about that. Okay. So I was at a party last night and we were playing that whole album and I totally didn't know you were doing that on stage until this morning. So it like blew my mind. I'm like, oh my God, we were just watching every video of this album.
Okay.
Cool. So what led you to this project with Alanis and what can we expect from this visually? What kind of show is this going to be? Like, what are we expecting from this?
Yeah, so, you know, American Idiot was a great success, and my background really is the music industry.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been working for myself for 14 years, so it's been a long time, but when I was working for others, it was the music industry, so the core of my experience is in music. So between that and the success of American Idiot, I was getting pitched really, a great number of music-related projects from, you know, successful musicians looking to potentially adapt their work for the stage, and the truth is, you know, most of them I didn't think made sense, or there was no clear story, or for whatever reason, it just felt like, you know, sticking a square peg in a round hole. But the idea of doing something with Alanis Morissette just made a lot of sense to me. You know, when I it had been a while since I had listened to the record, and when I put it back on, I realized, first of all, it holds up. You know, it sounded as fresh and as relevant and as passionate as it was when I first came out. But also the songs to me, you know, she sings these songs that are very epic and emotional and sort of play very big, if you will,
in the way
that like a U2 song, plays very big. But unlike U2, who, you know, sing about things like Where the Streets Have No Name and I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, and I love U2,
yeah.
So that's not a criticism, but it's the, you know, these big concepts, these big epic songs. Alanis' songs, if you look at the material, are very small and personal. So she'll sing as though she's singing to the back of the room, but she's singing about what happened to her 1 week over the summer.
Yep.
You know, and to me, that's the perfect recipe for a theatrical song. You know, in a lot of ways, it almost feels like those songs belong more on a Broadway stage than they do on the radio. It just felt kind of ready to go in that sense. And the album is not a concept record the way that American Idiot is a concept record, but there is a narrative in there. You know, there is a story about a young girl who's in a relationship with a man who controls more of the power in the relationship, and for whatever reason, he breaks up with her for reasons that aren't entirely clear. There's another woman in the picture. She gets very vilified in this process. She gets very upset about it, to say the least. She finds herself to a place of empowerment. And at the end of the album, at the end of the story, if you will, you know, I think it leaves us with a sense of hope. It doesn't necessarily have a happy ending, but you get a sense that this character is going to be okay.
Yeah.
And so right there, there's a lot of potential for narrative, you know, and I do want to do something that ups the stakes a little bit, that sets it on a bigger stage. And I don't mean physical stage. I mean, you know, a bigger narrative stage than just a girl in a relationship, which is a story I think we've seen 101 times,
sure.
You know, and I don't know exactly what that means. And literally where we're at with that process is we are out to writers, and we have a number of wonderful writers who are interested. And they're, you know, taking kind of what I just told you and telling me what their takes are on it. And you know, we will find the one that makes the most sense to us and that feels the most exciting and fresh. And I want to do something that, you know, that will be a little bit of a surprise for the fans, that will take the story in a slightly surprising direction. And, you know, I think when that record first came out, whether you liked it or didn't like it, definitely the first time you heard it, you had to stop and you took notice. You know,
yep.
What's that all about? You know, there was a knee-jerk reaction, and I want the story to be similar. I want, when you hear, oh, it's going to be about this, I want your immediate reaction to be like, whoa, you know, I'm not sure I like that, but that's intense, and that sounds really fascinating. And, you know, that's kind of how I want people to respond to the story. And, you know, we're working with Alanis. We have Tom Kitt, who did the orchestrations and arrangements for American Idiot, and who's a Tony and a Pulitzer Prize winner for Next to Normal. He's the creator of Next to Normal. He's doing our orchestrations and arrangements, and he's a wonderful guy and an old friend of mine, so it's a joy to be working with Tom again. And Tom and Alanis and I are starting to meet with writers. That's the next step, and I hope that I'll have more to tell you shortly, but I hope that gives you a sense of what we're doing with the piece.
If you can pull that off, if you can pull off making everyone feel the way they felt about the album when the album came out, I mean, then you're going to have to line up the Tonys. You'll be set, because that's how much the album resonated with people. So that's a tall order. It's a tall order. But I mean, if anyone can pull it off, it's you right now. The way you're on a roll right now, and
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
I guess I've always enjoyed projects that are a little edgy like that. You know, when I produced A Raisin in the Sun, everyone said, African Americans don't go to Broadway. Kids don't go to Broadway. You're crazy to do this play on Broadway. You're crazy to cast P. Diddy in the lead. American Idiot on Broadway was the same. It was like, you know, punk rock is not going to play on Broadway. Kids don't come to Broadway. You know, I guess I relish in something that's a challenge. It's going to push the medium forward a little bit. It's going to do something a little bit different. It's going to make people sit up and take notice. I mean, that's the heart of great art, and that's what I'm interested in at any rate. You know,
no, I love
I think
it.
In Broadway, definitely, I love the classics, and there's always a place for a good revival, but that's not what I do. It's not what I'm personally interested in working
on. No, I like that you're bringing original projects. By the way, I want everyone to know, I love your energy. You have amazing energy. Do you know that?
Thank you.
You really do.
Thank you. It's very kind of you to say.
It's infectious.
Well,
it's
that's another thing I've learned from the Brian Epstein story. I mean, you know, he attacked the Beatles and that project with an unrelenting amount of passion and persistence. And it's the only reason he accomplished what he accomplished. You know, every time he achieved something for the Beatles, he said, it's not good enough. It's not good that we're just hugely popular in Britain. We need to play for the Queen. And then after they played for the Queen and Beatlemania took hold of the country, you know, Britain's not enough. They're going to be bigger than Elvis. They're going to be world stars. We have to be big in America. And then that wasn't good enough. And, you know, then he pushed for Sgt. Pepper's to elevate pop music into an art form. And after Sgt. Pepper's, there was All You Need Is Love, you know, which was broadcast to 400 million people. And, you know, he was constantly looking for ways to push the boundaries of the business, or to allow the business to allow the Beatles to push the boundaries of their art. You know, again, this is all why I think he was a fifth member of the band, but his energy and his enthusiasm and his persistence, I think, was critical to their success. And you know, I've learned the same thing. It's like, do what you love and do it with passion and persistence, and life will be rewarding, and you'll make a difference. And
I love it.
And, you know, I don't know. It all goes back to Brian for me.
Can I ask you, because we're in Chicago here, you're in New York, what is the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman having effect on that community today?
Oh, it's awful. You know, I mean, Philip was such an amazing artist. You know, he really was an artist. I think of him, you know, not just as an actor, but as an artist. And, you know, I didn't know him very well, but I had met him on a couple of occasions, and he was also a very warm and funny guy. He's also, you know, my wife is from Rochester, and he's a Rochester boy, and so there was a little bit of a personal connection there. So it's been a very, very sad day, no question. And he was a New Yorker. He was one of us, you know, and we're in New York. I mean, the film industry is a small industry anyway, but the film industry in New York is a super small industry, and it's a huge loss. It really is a huge loss.
Yeah. It's just awful. No, I was just curious because everyone told me it's madness over there. And, you know, you lose a talent like that. He's irreplaceable. I mean, he's not one of those guys where you could say, okay, well, we'll recast him with so-and-so. Like, you can't even think like that, because who's going to replace Philip Seymour Hoffman?
That's right. That's right.
Let me ask you about back to the Fifth Beatle, about Brian. Died at a very young age. Where do you find the high points in his story without taking us too low to the fact that he was a young guy that died lonely?
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
When you're doing the film, obviously, I don't know, maybe you want everyone to leave the theater crying, but what high points are we going to celebrate? Is it mainly with the Beatles, or are you going to get deeper into his personal life? Because I got to imagine a lot of people weren't talking about his personal life until maybe the last 10 years or so, 20 years or so, when it became more accepted.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hope we'll have a good balance of both. You know, I'm obviously, as I said, a huge Beatles fan, and I think that story is really fascinating. But this really is the Brian Epstein story.
Right.
I mean, much like the graphic novel, the film is not going to be a way of telling the Beatles story through Brian Epstein's eyes. I mean, this is the Brian Epstein story, that's a story that I find very inspiring, mostly for personal reasons. And so, you know, the core of the story really is the human struggles that he faced, and how he, you know, achieved such amazing accomplishments in the face of those struggles, but also with a tragic ending, you know, the struggles eventually, you know, taking his life at such a young age. I mean, I think it is very, very inspiring and incredibly tragic at the same time.
Yeah.
And I actually don't think those two things negate each other. You know, I think that's what makes it such a believable and human story, is because we are mixed people as humans, you know, and then I think to find something that's both inspiring and tragic at the same time just feels very real. So I hope that we'll be both. You know, I hope that people will walk out of the theater crying and inspired.
I have a feeling you may get that.
The best art forms do both, you know?
You may get that. I have a feeling.
I guess
it was a bad question in a way, because I'm just sitting here thinking as a producer or as a screenwriter, I'm like, okay, how do I give everyone that studio ending that everyone wants to the story? Because there really kind of isn't, other than the fact you celebrated his achievements in his life. But that studio ending, I'm like, how do you do that?
Well, you know, it's not going to have a studio ending, maybe. You know,
that's
it's going to have a real ending.
Well, no, you push
things. But, you know, it's not, look, I mean, the story's not it's not about, you know, a tortured gay man and, you know, it doesn't have a deep focus on gay rights, although that is a huge part of the story. But, you know, you look at something like Milk, which was a fantastic movie, and you know, Bruce Cohen, my partner, my co-producer on
that's
the project,
right,
was one of the producers on Milk. And, you know, that's a story that has a very sad ending, but that I think leaves you incredibly inspired.
I agree.
And, you know, maybe that's not a studio ending, but it's a great film and was nominated for the Academy Award, you know,
and
we should be so lucky to be that powerful, you know, I think.
And
so
don't mind
me.
I'm just being devil's advocate. Don't mind me. Of course, I do not want to see any studio ending to this.
No, it's
I
a tough
it's
one, you know,
story.
And the truth is, look, when I think about the Brian Epstein story from a film perspective,
yeah,
you know, I always say, look, this is more of a inspiring human story than it is a biopic, even though technically it's a rock related biopic. But I always say, look, it's less Ray or Walk the Line, and it's more Rocky or Billy Elliot.
Yeah,
you know,
I can see
it's
that.
The least likely guy to succeed going the distance in their chosen field. And if we do our jobs correctly, you know, the same way you don't need to be a boxing fan to love Rocky, and you certainly don't need to be a fan of ballet to love Billy Elliot, you know, you don't need to be a Beatles fan to love the fifth Beatle. I mean, it will be an added treat if you are, because there are some Beatles stories in here that are unsung, untold stories. But you don't need to be a Beatles fan to love this story. You need to be a fan of an inspiring human tale. And you know, maybe Rocky is the best example. You know, if you remember the first Rocky, he loses at the end, you know, but it's the fact that he goes the distance with the champ that makes him the winner, you know, but he loses the fight. So again, you know, I don't know that I think Rocky still has a little bit more of a studio ending, if you will, than the fifth Beatle will. But the comparison, I think, is an apt one.
No, I think that's actually really interesting. That's a really fascinating way to look at that. I guess my last question I really have for you is, and it's a personal one, is you've had this great, great life, and you're still a really young guy. And, I mean, you've met everybody.
Well, thank you.
I mean, I know to you by now it's like old hat that you've met everybody, but do you appreciate, and I mean, of course, I know you're going to say yes, but I kind of want to know how much you appreciate it, that you've gotten to meet the Bruce Springsteens and the Paul McCartneys and these people. Has it ever really sunk in, other than maybe the first time or the second time you met some like really big legends?
You know, I mean, it's yeah. The short answer is yes. You know, I mean, I am a fan.
Yeah.
I feel incredibly grateful to do what I do on a daily basis. I don't ever take a day for granted. I really don't. I feel very, very lucky and blessed with the people that I work with and the projects I surround myself with. So I really do. I do want to say I'm incredibly grateful for all that. I don't take a day of it for granted, but I also try to every day also celebrate that. You know, and at the end of the day, I am a fan. You know, and that's not going to change. I think the day that changes, you know, is the day that I should stop doing what I'm doing. You know, I love it. I love every minute. And you know, any time I get to spend time with inspiring artists, that's a great day. You know, and I don't take those days for granted. They're still amazing days. You know, and the truth is, like, I don't get wrapped up in celebrity. It's just like it's a matter of being of inspiration, you know. And while somebody like Bruce Springsteen and Paul McCartney will inspire me, you know, sodas hanging out with, you know, my kids. You know, that sure. I find that inspiring, hanging out with Bruce Cohen and Peyton Reed, you know, who aren't household names, but my producer and my director on The Fifth Beatle. Like, that's an inspiring day. Like, I don't take any of those moments for granted, and I celebrate them all. It never gets tired.
Yeah,
it never gets tired.
I guess the point being is you have an amazing life. You should celebrate it. I'm very happy for your success. I mean, I think you're a great guy. And, you know, I was,
you know, there's Brian Epstein once said, they were asking, yeah, him, you know, what do you enjoy most in your life? And, you know, he said, most of all, and it's in the book, you know, it's in an interview sequence that comes about halfway through the book. He said, you know, far beyond anything that money can buy, I love to just lean back at the back of the concert hall and watch the curtain rise on my artists, because deep down inside, I'm just a fan like every other fan. And that's kind of how I feel.
Yeah,
you know, that's an apt analogy for both my Broadway shows, my films, my book. You know, it's just at the end of the day, I just love standing in the back and watching the curtain rise, or standing in the back and cracking the seams of that graphic novel, or you know, waiting for the lights to fade in the cinema. I mean, those are the best moments, is just sitting back as a fan and getting to experience the art and the type of art that can inspire me over and over again. That's what I want to surround myself with.
As a director, I have to say that's the best moment to end this on.
that's it, right?
You just summed it all up. Thank you so much for joining us. The Fifth Beatle, the graphic novel.
No, thank
you.
And hey, before I leave, yeah, I do want to make want to let you guys know, because I just confirmed this the other day, is that I am going to be out in Chicago.
Oh, great!
I'm going to be there for C2E2.
Oh, great!
For the Comics and Entertainment Conference in April.
Yes.
I don't know my exact schedule yet, but I'll be in town Friday the 25th until Sunday the 26th. I think it is.
That's great.
I'm sorry, Friday the 25th to Sunday the 27th. And I will be doing a panel on pop music and comics, and I'll be doing a signing of the Fifth Beatle. So I will be in Chicago, and you know, if you follow us on fifthbeatle.com or on our Facebook page or on Twitter at Fifth Beatle, we'll let you know the exact schedule once it's set in stone. But I'm very much looking forward to getting out there.
That's fantastic. I can't wait to meet you. That'll be exciting.
Yeah, I was there last year for C2E2, and it was a wonderful time. So I haven't been back to Chicago since, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much. We had a blast doing this. Come on, anytime.
I would love to. And, you know, if there's a chance to meet in person when I'm out there for C2E2, I'd love to do that.
I'll be there. I'm there every year. I'll be there.
Let's do it. And by then, I hope to have some film news to share with you as well.
Great.
Some casting news and so hopefully there'll be some fresh Fifth Beatle information.
Great. Well, thank you very much. The Fifth Beatle, you can get that graphic novel pretty much everywhere now. Where's the best place to get it? Amazon, would you say? Or at thefifthbeatle.com?
Yeah, I mean, it's available online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and IndieBound.
Yeah.
And in physical stores, it should be in wherever books are sold, as they say, and certainly at your local comic shop. But again, if you go to fifthbeatle.com,
yes,
we do have a store section on the site that will point you in a few different directions.
Yeah, fifthbeatle.com.
To where to pick it up. But it's thankfully easy to find. So,
no, thank
you. I would love it if your audience would check it out. Thank you for the support.
Thank you very much. And best of luck with the Alanis show, too. That sounds like a great time.
Yeah, thank you. You know, and certainly by April, when I see you at C2E2, I'll definitely have more news on that.
I can't wait.
So I'd love to talk to you some more about that.
Okay, well, thank you so much, and we'll be back with more after this. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure being on.
Yeah, well, okay.
And
go ahead.
We're back.
Lee, you could talk, Lee.
Hey,
that was good.
That's Luisi pretending he heard the interview, which I would not.
Kyan's good. You noticed that, huh?
Yeah.
I was off the air for a minute. Hokely dokely. So what else do we want to talk about before we wrap up? That was good.
That was good.
Vivek's great. During that interview, we got caught up in
a
Woody Allen conversation.
Conversation
and about
how
much we don't care.
And how much we really don't like that everybody has to weigh in, like their opinion matters at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
As we weigh in. We don't have to.
So do we have to make fun of Anthony or Mike?
No, we got no one to make fun of.
Sometimes I just don't want to make fun of everybody. I like all those guys.
Thanks.
I have I came up with a great movie idea the other day.
Well, don't say it on the air.
I'm not, but I'm just thinking about how great I am.
Wow, man. And the snow gets deeper in Chicago.
Yeah.
What does that even mean? The snow gets deeper?
What is that?
You want to explain your joke?
No.
Oh, it's over our heads. It's over our heads, Lee.
Hoo-ah!
That good. It's that good.
It's getting deep. It's
No, Vivek's great. The Fifth Beatle, you can get the Fifth Beatle on the website for the Fifth Beatle.
Very cool. You know, did you look at it?
Yeah, it's amazing,
right? Looks like, the artwork looks like some of the advertising from that era. From the early 60s, you know.
I thought it was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the way they tell stories in that book. Like,
uh-huh.
And I thought it was a fascinating way to tell that story. I think that's a really cool medium.
I just like that a guy who's like such a big Broadway player does a graphic novel, writes a graphic novel.
Yeah, he grew up on it.
He's involved in a lot of shit.
Yeah.
He's on boards and...
Yeah, and yeah. He grew up on it, you know. He loved comics, and that was his thing. So, you know, I just thought... You know, it's smart, too, because how many people really read books anymore?
Right.
Right?
I know.
Graphic novels are probably just as hot as books.
Well, they're...
So that's a fascinating way to do it. And
they're
what
more of a commodity now, but also I don't find any shame in calling them comic books.
Well, let me tell you, though, why he's so smart. Because if you make a graphic novel, you've now storyboarded out a movie while making money doing it.
Right.
So now... You take that graphic novel and you show it to producers, like the producer of Milk and Silver Linings, who's doing the movie, and he probably looks at it and can see a movie because it looks like a storyboard. That's a graphic novel looks like a storyboard.
That's true, but I'm someone that thinks that you can't just mindlessly adapt panels and have that be a comic book movie. I'm looking in your direction, Zack Snyder.
Well, you can. Zack Snyder does it all the time.
Yeah, but you, I mean...
You mean for
to make
it to be good.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say, people do it.
Yeah, I know.
All the time. Yeah. Some people make Watchmen out of it.
Yeah.
Let's see. Anything else going on?
I'll tell you something.
You got something?
The thing with the Beatles anniversary of the Sullivan performance, I'm a little bothered that it's like that's known as the birth of the Beatles. Like before
Sullivan. You're bothered that people are under the impression no one knew the Beatles
until
that moment.
But more the impression that it's for America to validate a group. They're not truly famous until we say they are.
That's right.
They are for our validation.
Yep.
That's fascinating.
Yep.
United States. Does that bother anybody else?
Not me.
Why? Why? Explain that. Why? Okay. So,
I don't think I'm.
No. You're. Well, you're
you
right.
Have an opinion?
You're right.
I mean, I work in music, and there are so many like.
You're right. You're right.
Today, there are so many like. English artists who are so undercredited. And I like more English artists than I do American artists. But it's just, it's America.
Fuck yeah.
That's me trying to start the discussion.
I tried.
I agree
with you, Lee.
What else we got? Fart machine?
Yeah. I'll bring the fart machine next week.
Please.
Okay.
I love the fart machine. I think the fart machine's highly underrated.
You know, I was getting a little short with the fart machine because Matt was using it so much, but it's been so long, I kind of wanted to make another appearance.
You miss it. You miss the fart machine.
Because for fart noises, all we have are us talking.
Back to episode 2.
Yeah, right.
Let's see. Anything else going on? Movies start shooting in like 12 days?
Beautiful.
Wow.
Do you have a...
No.
Okay.
Whatever the question is.
See to
no,
your pants, huh?
Not yet.
Okay.
Putting together the shot list now.
Okay.
Finishing up on costumes. Think locations are good. I got to check in with Melissa.
What are you going
to
start with? Exteriors? Establishing shots?
We are doing one day of that, but I think that's the last day of shooting in February.
Food's all good.
Are we going to be sick on bocce pizza from the shoot?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. People need to be on their A game, okay?
Well, at least we know what our documentary is going to be called.
Yeah.
The Taste of Cardboard. The making of.
The shoot sponsored by Mylanta.
Yeah, right.
They actually catered that Chicago show.
Because there's no Cassanos in Chicago. That's the problem.
Well, at least they're going to have Giordano's at Wrigley. You see that at least?
Oh, is that what they're doing now? Did you see Connie's moved into Trader Vic's?
Yeah.
That's unreal.
That's unreal.
They'll be out of business. First of all, Lou Malnati's is a block down. Gino's East is like six blocks down.
Right.
Homemade Pizza Company's a block down.
Right.
They're going to be out of business. How can they afford to be in Trader Vic's? That building's huge.
I think they were
their restaurant's huge.
They were kept alive solely by Wrigley.
And Comiskey when it was at Comiskey.
Uh-huh.
But then Comiskey did the smart thing and they changed to DiGiorno.
DiGiorno.
A Chicago institution.
Yeah, right.
DiGiorno.
Yeah.
Is it Gino's East or Giordano's moved into LaSalle Power Company?
I don't know that.
By Rock and Roll McDonald's.
Huh. I did not know that. I didn't know anyone moved into LaSalle Power Company.
Yeah, the LaSalle Power Company.
I thought it's still just closed.
No, it's either going to be...
What?
I think it's Gino's.
It's Gino. I think it's
Hold on. You two, yeah. I'll look.
No, you're right. It's either Gino's East or Giordano's.
Yeah.
I think it's Gino's East.
No, I was driving
it's
by.
It's a big place.
I was driving by Ed DeVevick's over there.
Gino's East.
Yeah, Gino's East.
Yeah,
it's a big move.
You were correct. Gino's East.
I mean,
wait, Gino's East isn't moving. They're just putting in a new one.
I think they're.
You're saying it's moving.
I'm not sure.
Oh, they are moving their River North location.
Yeah,
they are moving. That's their big money maker. They're going to be shut down for a week or two, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should try to get that as a living space when they move
out.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Looking
across
for River North.
Across from Al's Beef, I'll never eat again.
Oh,
and Ed DeBevick's.
Ed DeBevick's.
And I'll never eat again.
Yeah.
Which, if Al's Beef was the only fast food in your town, you'd cook every day, wouldn't you?
Cook every day.
I would cook every day.
I would eat bocce.
Yeah.
I would eat bocce's.
Al's Beef is the equivalent to pizza for what Bocce's is to pizza.
Yeah, but if you're that
That's
close,
true.
You could walk to Mr. Beef on Orleans.
Yeah.
Some of you guys don't like.
Mr. Beef. No,
yeah.
Not me.
Okay.
You know I'm on page with you with that. I love Mr.
Those
Beef
Those are my
on
friends,
Orleans.
Too, the guy.
I love Mr. Beef on Orleans. I can tell there's a difference since your friends took over.
Yeah.
However, I don't think it's negligible. Put it this way. Not only is it negligible, I don't even think it's a negative difference. It's just a lateral difference in a way. It's just a different...
Are they Greek?
There's just a little different taste. Oh. The fries are done a little differently.
A little differently. They're still not all that great.
I don't think they're fresh cut anymore.
No.
Right?
No.
Yeah, they're frozen. That's the difference.
Yeah.
By the way, someone said to me, why do you want to make all these movies in Chicago?
Why wouldn't you? There's so much.
Well, I think they're asking more, why do I want to keep making low-budget movies
Georgia,
in Chicago?
You get a tax credit.
And you know why? Because you know what's not in this movie? Gene and Jude's. You know what's not in this movie? Mr. Beef. You know what's not in this? I mean, there's so many things I got to do.
I mean, you make something there, you don't want to have it be all Chicago locations.
No,
you don't want to have that upstage
story. But that's the point. I got to make like 10 other movies to fit everything in.
Yeah.
Because you got to find the right moments and shit, too.
Yeah.
You don't want to force a Gene and Jude scene.
You can't just have the characters that fucking in line at Hot Dogs for no reason just to work Hot Dogs into it.
Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, right.
He's not allowed to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he says so.
You know, Vince annoys me, though. I mean, Cusack, I think, is at least a little cool because when Cusack does Chicago movies, they're not the most interesting locations, but no one really films... Let's just be honest, and I know no one wants to admit this, but Cusack kind of made Wicker Park cool.
Yeah.
I hate to say this. I mean, look, I don't think it's a coincidence that they both got hot at the same time.
Yeah.
Late 90s, Cusack, Wicker Park.
You're talking about High Fidelity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hipster central. What's a hipster's favorite movie, High Fidelity? It's got to be. It's in the top. Top 20.
And I'm part hipster and I like High Fidelity.
I love High Fidelity and I love
I
like Wicker Park.
Two people I know were in that movie from my high school.
Yeah.
Part.
So
10-15%.
I mean, I give him credit for a lot of Chicago stuff, even though, you know, he's an asshole. But Vaughn, here's my problem with Vince. Vince is a guy that seems to have forgotten that he was ever like poor. Is this fair? Is this fair? Because all his movies, no matter how much his character earns, they could be earning $40,000 or his character could be rich. They all take place in the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
In the Loop.
He's got these giant apartments.
Unaffordable apartments. In $8,002 apartments in River North.
The worst offender of that is Sandler. And with him, it's almost like a joke. Like he's inviting you to remark, like, how does a guy who works one day a week in a toll booth live in the biggest apartment
loft?
I'll give you the one thing about Sandler though is, I don't think anyone gives a shit because it's Sandler, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
he gets by.
We expect very little from Adam, that's, so he gets by with it.
That's so crazy.
But when I watch Vince Vaughn make a movie like, what's the last one he did that was awful with Ron Howard? That Alan Lowe wrote.
I can't even remember that.
Started with a D, right? The Dilemma.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And I'm watching this, and he plays a gambling addict who pitches car ideas to car companies. I've never even heard of this job in my life. It's one of those in-the-movie jobs.
Right.
And he lives in this, like, fucking ritzy fucking apartment. Oh, okay. Perfect example. Okay. The Breakup, directed by Peyton Reed. So I'm going to try not to rip on this too bad since he's directing the movie of the guest we had on today. But,
that's true.
And I don't think The Breakup's as bad as some people do. But he plays a tour guide who owns a company with two of his brothers. And he's not even the owner of it. It's D'Onofrio's character that owns it. So he's a guy that works for a tour company in Chicago. Now, I know guys that work for tour companies in Chicago. If they don't have roommates, they're in an apartment that's maybe $1,000 a month. Him and Jennifer Aniston together, because she works at an art dealer place, but she's like an assistant there or something.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine she makes that much. And they get that ridiculous condo in The Breakup.
Right.
They
like
buy this
bedroom.
Like $4 million loop that, Chicago
that
condo.
That place was awesome.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's a $4 million home.
It's a pussy penthouse.
Right. And it's just, like, so ridiculous. It's like, Vince, why can't you shoot at any locations that, like, regular people go to? Why can't you shoot in any apartments that, like, real people are at? So what's special
about
this movie is...
We're not
going
to believe that you're a guy that's out to just crush puss if you have a regular man's apartment.
Right. What I can promise you about this movie is you will see real Chicago in the movie.
Yeah.
My brother's apartment...
Your brother's apartment's one scene. It's one scene, and it's a party, and it's not supposed to be anyone's place, so it makes sense. Obviously, you know some rich people. Everybody has the rich friend or the rich, like, friend of a friend who invites you places, and you end up at someone's rich house. That happens.
Yeah.
That's the only rich thing in the whole movie.
Okay.
So, you know, we dip our toes into the Vince Vaughn waters, but we don't live there. We don't live there.
Yes,
we check the temperature of the water,
someday,
and we say this.
It's new.
This is fecal matter.
Someday I can aspire to have an apartment like a Vince Vaughn character.
Yeah, right. Or Adam Sandler.
Or
yeah.
Real Vince Vaughn.
You know, that's another thing. So I haven't watched Looking yet, but someone told me, you know, they all play like poor people. And they all have fancy apartments.
On HBO,
and
I
know
it.
Anything about gay people,
or
yeah,
HBO.
Right. Like HBO can afford anything. Yeah. Like, yeah, that's what, girls. Okay.
Oh God.
How do they rent that apartment?
Not at all.
Well, they had first of all
in the first season.
In the first
season, I'm talking
about
in the first season when they make no money, none of
that. None of that, and part of the show is about that she has money problems, and
right.
Doesn't have a place to live. But then that kind of just goes away.
It does. It goes away.
In such a complete way that we're meant to think that she doesn't have any problems
right.
anymore because she gets by as a barista.
It's all about her and boys now. That's it.
Right.
Yeah. That's all it's about now. So anyways, what was it? Looking? Looking, supposedly, they're all like, you know, poor, but they live in these like big fucking apartments. All right. I know poor gay people. They sleep on mattresses on the floor with a roommate. Who's in the same studio apartment as them with a mattress on
right.
the floor.
And they have jobs.
Yeah, and they have jobs.
Yeah.
So I do understand what people say when they watch these shows. But then the other thing you got to remember is, how am I going to fit a film crew into a studio apartment and properly shoot a scene? There's no space.
I'm going to tell you something.
We're going to find out.
There hasn't been...
Well, those scenes. Yeah, but those scenes are intimate. So it's okay to have a studio apartment for those scenes.
Yeah.
Because you're supposed to feel intimate. But... In these, like Lee was talking about, in these, like, Sandler movies, we don't need to feel intimate at Adam's seven-bedroom condo, even though he's a toll booth operator.
Right.
Hey, that taxi was huge that ran him over.
Which Big Daddy was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Big Daddy, he lived in this, like, loft in Manhattan.
Well, he had a bedroom that was, like, a separate, like,
right.
like a treetop tower that you had to walk upstairs, and then it had a walkway going from it to another bedroom that looked out over this. That place was amazing.
It's ridiculous.
It had a putting green up top.
You're
yeah.
right.
Outside.
Even Kathy Bates had the most mansion-like trailer ever in Waterboy.
I mean, that was...
yeah,
that,
like that place
shit,
was huge for a trailer.
I find that
yeah.
shit obscene.
He is obscene.
Because already I can't
everything
get
Adam does
that,
is
those
obscene.
Things stand off to me, though. There hasn't been a major studio movie to seriously show genuine poverty and genuine poor people since... I got to go back to 8 Mile.
Mm-hmm.
That long.
Mm-hmm.
The cameras are getting smaller where they could fit them in places.
I can't believe I'm going to make this argument, but the one movie where Adam's place wasn't ridiculous was Chuck and Larry.
Yeah.
That was the one movie
okay. yeah.
where he didn't have a ridiculous
kind of
place.
And then
Adam at least got smarter and was like, all right, in this movie I got to play a plastic surgeon because we're using this mansion up here.
Right, right. You know, it doesn't make sense for me to be a shoe shine
yeah, right.
and live in a mansion right. or whatever the fuck kind of character I'm playing.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And then don't forget, in Zohan, he has to crash with the foreign couple.
Right, there's always
that's
some half-assed explanation.
Yeah, but it was
yeah, right.
Oh, he got run over by a taxi, that's why. He got all this money.
I actually kind of like Zohan. I actually thought there was some legitimate humor
it's
in that movie.
Not the worst thing that he's done.
No,
in his 10
but
years,
but
so.
But I think people hated it. Right? It wasn't popular.
I don't know.
Was Zohan popular?
What was the one? Of,
was I don't know. I thought of
Little Nicky.
What is he? Play an Iranian hairdresser?
Yeah,
I think
no, he's an Israeli
hairdresser.
He's an ex-Mossad, and he wants to be a hairdresser.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's great. Which one, Little Nicky? Yeah, even Hell had some sweet pads going on.
That
place was
that house,
huge.
That house is huge.
That was the highest yeah. budget movie he made, though, probably.
Little Nicky?
Yeah.
Well, at that time, yeah. yeah. Oh, yeah, at that time. Even Happy Gilmore. Grandma's house was huge.
Yeah.
That's true. Happy Gilmore's
Billy
great.
Madison? The estate?
Well, yeah, of course,
well, but
Billy
he,
Madison.
That, again,
he's
he,
supposed to
he,
play
he,
a
yeah.
rich kid
yeah.
boy there.
Even
yeah.
his tent was huge.
Love how we're debating... all
yeah.
the pla- and I
let's
love how we know all the
every
places
single
Adam
one I know.
Sandler lived in
right.
in all his movies.
So hot.
51st Date.
Yeah.
That was a sweet little Hawaiian pad.
Egregious.
And as we figured out, nothing's cheap in Hawaii.
No, nothing.
Even like a one-bedroom apartment.
Have you been to Hawaii?
No. You told me about it.
It's so expensive, we can't make
a,
it to Hawaii.
A quarter-pounder meal at McDonald's is like $9.
For real?
Yeah, because it's an island. You can't get supplies there. Everything's fucking completely ludicrously
why
priced.
Is the... That's what you and I both liked about The Descendants, that they showed a different part of Hawaii.
Yes.
Why is housing so expensive there?
Because there's a very finite amount of it.
Because it's a
really?
Fucking island. There's no land.
And it's Polynesia.
Now,
yeah.
how much... Well, hold on. He says that, but the islands, the smaller islands that you don't hear anything about, the housing there is not very expensive.
There's a lot of restrictions on house building and
really?
Development there. Yep.
Because of the terrain.
Hmm.
Because
natural land. And
so it is like it is like a hot commodity.
Very hot.
Yeah.
To have any kind of real estate there.
I would imagine so.
Wow.
It's like building...
There's a
we
show
talking,
called Buying Hawaii where
really?
They just sell people real estate in Hawaii.
Really?
Yeah. And there's
I may
one
watch
called,
that.
Yeah.
It's like building a house in the mountains in
Luis,
Colorado.
Microphone.
It's like building a house in Colorado. You can't do it anymore. Everything's protected and...
Oh, God. I'm on Facebook,
oh,
and
geez.
I don't know whether I'm going to laugh or cry. Someone thought... This is what I'm talking about Facebook. You see these Facebook movies... That everyone
yes.
made
what
yesterday.
Is that? What is that? I don't know what that is.
Tony had a good one.
I guess everyone gets like a minute movie that you can get made by Facebook. That basically they pick like your first two or three pictures from when you joined Facebook and your last two or three pictures, and then they pick some of your most popular statuses and they play like a little
yeah.
like picture like with Patch Adams like music underneath. It's really gay. It's stupid. It sucks. I made a comment on Facebook that I wanted so many people's movies to end like Terms of Endearment, but
yeah.
No.
I would like to do a thing where I'd like post, here's my Facebook movie,
mm-hmm.
and I would click it, and it would just play the movie Flowers in the Attic.
It's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you should do. So this is like what people think is like worthy to post on Facebook. Some guy posted a picture of him running on a treadmill watching Miss Congeniality, and then decided to wish Sandy good luck at the Oscars.
Mm-hmm. I thought about running away when I saw that movie.
Yeah, right. No, but he's running in one place watching the movie.
I want to get away but can't.
Yeah, right. Someone posted about Elton John making Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat movie. That should be awesome.
No, the best one was...
That's going to be awesome. Elton John making a movie about Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat is awesome.
He has the coat.
I know. He's got to.
Yeah.
The best comment on the movies was, thank you, Facebook, for showing me how many whores I dated past the 10-year mark.
Oh, my God.
Alex Luisi, everybody.
Then a lady friend of mine who was acting in a short where she gets, like, domestically abused decided to post a picture of her in all full beat-up makeup. So that's lovely.
Really?
Yeah, like black eye and shit. God.
And
like,
people
oh, yeah.
are going to think that that's real.
Uh-huh.
And like,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Let's see. My friend Jacqueline asks, what's your favorite STD?
I like Jacqueline.
That's, okay.
The ones that I got rid of. You just get
I will
shot.
Say this. This is a good use of Facebook. Kristen Toomey. This is a good use of Facebook.
She's funny.
Is the parking ban when snow is over 2 inches until it all melts or just while it's snowing? Very good question. That is what Facebook's for.
I'll tell you. It has to be cleared.
So that's what she said. So it has to be gone.
It has to be melted.
The thing about Facebook, I rag on it a lot, but it can have a proper use.
Yes.
We can use it to band together as one and make the world a better place. We could use Facebook, all of us, could use Facebook to join together as one, go to the biggest city in the world, go to the tallest building in that city, go to the top floor, find the biggest office, grab the guy out of his fucking leather-padded chair, and throw him into the deepest, darkest hole we as a society can create. That's what we should use Facebook for.
That's a good dream.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone thought this was important to post. Olivia Newton-John and the Flamingo Hotel have decided to have a residency together. So Olivia will be performing at the Flamingo.
I was just in Vegas last week.
That may be the worst idea ever. Well, the Flamingo's all like 90-year-olds anyways that go there.
Yeah.
Did you come to the Flamingo with Lenny and I? Was it you that was with us when we had the buffet at the Flamingo that was terrible?
Yes.
And it was all like 80-year-olds.
It was the worst.
And it was the worst buffet, but it was all like 80-year-olds.
But they got
people.
Olivia Newton-John.
Yeah, but they're going to have... Does
Is
that mean Donnie
performing?
And Marie are out?
I don't. Yeah, I know.
I'm worried.
Is she going to be performing with John Travolta and his carpet sample haircut?
Remember that video?
I know.
Oh, my God. Woo. Oh, my God.
What happened to Donnie and Marie?
What does that mean for Donnie and Marie? The Vegas gossip. Let's see. Oh, did you see, by the way,
the
Newsroom
family.
Last year is going to be next year.
Wow, really?
Made it a whopping 3 seasons.
Thank God.
Sorkin claims he doesn't want to do it anymore.
You know what, though? I watched a very interesting interview with Sorkin with Dan Rather. Did you see this?
Mm-hmm. No, I haven't.
Oh,
No. What happened?
Really, basically, Rather asks him about some of the complaints about the show, and he addresses them. He goes, well, you know, some people think that you're using hindsight to create drama because you're talking about things that have already happened and doing it in a way that's kind of an artificial kind of poignancy. And he goes, well, the whole thing with that is I really like that moment when you know more than the characters know. That's the whole reason I like that. I'm like, yeah, but that's weak.
Yeah.
That's not something a few good men Sorkin would do.
Yeah.
That was...
That's the equivalent of when Lena Dunham was like, when they're like, how come you don't have any, like, other people other than white people on your show? And she's like, I just don't know any. And then she cast Donald Glover the next year for, like, one episode.
Oh, yeah.
That's, like, that kind of excuse where it's, like, really half-baked.
Right.
Like, it's like...
Now, that was a good movie.
I wouldn't... Here's the thing. I wouldn't kick her for that because I think that's
No,
really...
I do kick her for that because she went out and hired Donald Glover immediately.
Oh, yeah. No.
Which says that answer
but
previously was bullshit.
Her response was fine.
Yeah, the response was fine.
The
response... She stole that from her archenemy, Woody Allen. That was Woody Allen's response to why there's no black people
Who
in
she
his
hates.
Movie. What are you doing? You don't know what you're doing. This tells you how loud people are. This is why you can hear more of me. This is for the headphones only, Alex. This is for everybody else.
We're closing in on a point, too.
Yeah, well, she stole it from Woody Allen, who she hates.
Yeah.
That is exactly word for word what Woody said. I just don't know any black people.
Yeah.
And then Woody looked like an idiot to him, put a black woman in deconstructing Harry.
Right.
Like, literally, it was literally before that movie.
As a prostitute.
And then, yeah, right, and then as a prostitute, which I give him a lot more cred for than Lena,
I think
who's like, okay.
Harry is kind of underrated.
I think it's good, too.
Yeah.
But it's the equivalent of, here's what I think really happened with Lena. And this is where I think Aaron Sorkin's answer's bullshit, too.
Uh-huh.
I think they're all called out on this stuff. They come up with, like, some half-baked answer that actually makes sense, though. Like, Sorkin's, it's logical.
It is logical. I agree.
But
in the
same with Lena.
He comes across very likable. He appreciates Dan Rather as interviewing him.
Right.
He's very forthcoming, but there's something about that answer that rubbed me the wrong way.
Well, here's what I think Hamlin and Lena Dunham
think. I don't share that complaint about in the newsroom. I have other complaints about it.
I would have no problem with Lena Dunham if she was like, I don't know, any black people or Mexican people or whatever people.
Yeah.
I don't know how to write for them.
No.
Okay, cool.
David Mamet doesn't know.
Right.
Doesn't write women because he doesn't know anything about them.
That's not true. He writes his wife and everything.
Well, that's
right. Outside of his wife.
He has to be married to
yeah.
the woman
right.
to write her.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So here's why I think I would have Lena thing, and this is why I think that's bullshit, and this is why I think girls overall is kind of bullshit. I think Lena is very...
I like about it, but...
I do, too. We talked about that. Yeah. I do like things about it, but I think overall Lena listens to, like, what Twitter people say, and Twitter people are stupid. So I think what happened was she got called out on this, and she's like, I don't know any black people. And then Twitter people were like, you really want black people? And she's like, oh, Judd, I do know a black person. Donald Glover.
Right.
And Judd's like, that's great, Lena. And they went out, and they hired Donald Glover, and they're like, see? Black people.
Oh. Well...
He's only around for two episodes, too.
One episode.
So it's like, here's your black person.
Well, really telling are, when you watch an HBO show, they do an interview after the episode if you watch it on
That's
demand.
Right. That's right.
Where it's a look inside the episode where they basically ruin it for you by
mm-hmm.
explaining it.
Yep.
Well, but she does one for every episode of the show. And it's very telling when you watch those because she'll say things like, we wanted to do an episode where we got the two male characters together because it was something the fans wanted to see and we really liked these characters.
That's what I'm talking about.
She's listening to the fans. And I get it probably comes from a good place. She wants to please the viewers. All right. But at the same time...
But let's say she has 500,000 fans,
that she
though, right?
She shouldn't care?
Right. But let's say she has 500,000 fans. Or what is the show
probably
average?
More than that.
Sometimes the show averages 1 million viewers, okay?
Right.
How many fans are clamoring for it? Maybe if 1,000 fans on Twitter say, man, I'd like to see these male characters together, is 1/100th of your audience enough for you to write an entire episode around? How does she really know what her fans want?
Right.
You're not talking to all 1 million people. Is that a really good poll size to go by that people on Twitter said this would be awesome?
Right, and those episodes of Girls that feel like they were written to please specific parts of the audience are not the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
The good ones are other ones. Some of them are great, like excellent. But, all right.
No, I'm with you.
We've exhausted this.
Yeah, there's nothing really else to talk about tonight. We'll be back next Wednesday. I don't know with who yet or what or whatever.
I'll be here.
You'll be here? Yeah. It'll be our last show before we film.
Really?
We'll be doing them while we film.
Okay.
We're going to be talking about making the film when we do those.
We should have those downtown in some nice restaurant or something.
yes.
Okay.
We should go.
Yeah. Whatever you want.
All right. After filming, we're going to go to the Tortoise Club.
That's fine. I like the Tortoise Club. What was that?
Nothing. Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah.
We are filming a movie and we are very excited about it, and you can follow us along at Twitter and we will take your comments and we will base our film around them.
No, we won't.
I can't let this go. This girl.
Oh, girls.
So who's on next week?
I don't know yet.
Pat!
Tobias doesn't tell me these things till Monday.
Pat.
Here's how it works. Tobias goes Monday morning. Hey, so-and-so's coming on. I go, oh, that's great. I'll tell Lee. I'll get everyone pumped about blah, blah. Yeah, you're interviewing him in 3 minutes.
Can you get to your house and computer and whatever in 3 minutes?
Pat, if you're listening, are you feeling okay? How's the sinus infection?
Oh, who cares?
I've never
the sinus infection.
I
they
still
blow. You've never had one?
No, I've had one, but I'm just saying I've never
Pat,
met Pat.
Afrin,
so I don't know if he's alive.
Afrin, 12 hours. You get 12 hours out of it, okay?
Oh, man. My sinus infections in L.A. were brutal. Brutal. I wouldn't leave the house.
Really?
That's a sign.
I had sinus
of the
infection
air?
Like October, November. Yep.
He might, have to go to, he might have to go to rehab. That's a sign of a coke addict.
No, it's not.
He
doesn't have a coke addiction.
He could.
Although it would explain a lot.
I do cocaine. I can tell you that's not correct.
Yeah. First of all,
I still don't believe Pat's alive.
Everyone at this table has done a lot of blow.
I've never done.
You haven't?
Never.
I have. Matt has.
I've never
Matt's
done drugs.
Done more than I have, but
I blow all the time, pal.
Yeah.
All the time. I love it.
It's pretty great.
What?
I've never done drugs before, so.
What's his face is getting out of jail this year from the movie Blow? Ryan told me.
Who?
Ted Demme?
No, he's dead.
Oh, that's right, he does.
The guy the movie's about.
George Jung?
Yeah, George Jung. He's
let's
gets have, out of jail
let's
this
have
year.
Him on the show.
We should.
Oh,
we
yeah?
should. We should write up. Let's write him a prison letter.
Let's write him a treatment.
And send it to him.
Yeah.
No, a letter in prison and say, come on the show when you get out, would you?
Not that kind of treatment.
Bring the good stuff.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
That would be kind of interesting.
Could we get him?
I think we could.
It's kind of a big deal, though, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, you know what? There's going to be a little bit of media blitz when he gets out.
Yeah.
Once
yeah.
that dies down, he's all ours.
Yeah.
That's true. When he's a loser again.
He can tell us stories about Johnny Depp.
No, we'll
yeah,
start
when
dealing,
he's a loser again, he's
we'll
all
start
ours.
Dealing,
yeah, right.
We'll start dealing coke with him.
Okay, we're going to go. Next week, we'll be joined by whoever. And anything else going on?
Nothing. We do not deal coke, by the way.
Yeah. Cayenne's hungry. We got to go. Bye.
Okay.